If the name Gregory Hoblit sounds familiar, yet you can't place it, it's probably because you've seen it roll by in the credits of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. Hoblit worked as both a producer and director of Hill Street Blues and won 4 Emmys for the show. In 1987, he won Emmys as co-executive producer of L.A. Law and director of the pilot episode. And in 1988, he won an Emmy for directing the pilot of Hooperman. Hoblit directed a new made-for-TV movie called Roe vs. Wade. It will be broadcast May 15th on NBC's Monday Night at the Movies. It tells the story of the case that legalized abortion. Amy Madigan plays the attorney who argued the case in Texas, then took it to the Supreme Court. Holly Hunter stars as the woman who wanted to terminate her pregnancy and agreed to become the anonymous plaintiff in a class action suit. Abortion is a loaded subject for television. I asked Hoblit if he had to show the script to representatives of both sides of the issue.
We didn't have to do that at all, no. I don't think we were obligated to, but the script was seen in its various stages by the people upon whom it was based, namely Flowers and Floyd and Sarah and Norman. Norma, they all read the script as it was being written. They have all seen the movie. We really went to great lengths, I would say, to maintain the integrity of their feelings and thoughts and at the time.
So the lawyers on both sides of the case and the plaintiff all read the script.
Oh yes.
And did they suggest changes that you made?
They were interested in accuracy. I mean, Sarah would be interested, she says, I wouldn't have said that. Or this date or this action, this activity didn't take place in this time. Jay Floyd the same. Norma the same. They were really concerned that they were portrayed in a way that made them comfortable.
Network standards and practices usually deals with advocacy groups. Did you have to report to standards and practices on the script, and did they have any suggested revisions?
Oh yes, but standards and practices was not in position per se as it used to be. It may be in the future because of all the heat that this movie and is taking, and you know the problems now with other programs and other networks that are taking some heat. This project was begun 4 years ago and was sort of wound its way through the legal and standards and practices machinery of the network over that period of time, often bottlenecked, utterly stuck, as there were concerns over the legal aspects of it, the balance of it, the possibility of advocacy groups mounting campaigns against it, as we're now seeing.
What kind of campaigns have there been against this movie?
Well, from reading the LA Times this morning, and I just quoted an article out of the New York Times, there have been a number of groups. Most notably, I think, Reverend Wildman, is that his name, from
mm-hmm.
Tupelo,
mm-hmm.
who has begun a letter-writing campaign. Has said a number of things about the movie, portraying it as is positively pro-choice. He has never seen the movie. He admits to that. He just seems to feel free to make those pronouncements. And I gather there's a number of other groups. I read a letter a while back from a woman from New Jersey who in essence said if certain things weren't in the movie and she could be assured of it, that she would mount a boycott against any consumers and companies wanting to promote their products on the movie.
Let me ask you this: since the Supreme Court decision was pro-choice, is there anything wrong if the movie is pro-choice?
Well, there's two aspects to that. The Supreme Court did give it a point of view, you know, historically, politically, socially. There's no doubt about it. It came down on the side of Roe. By telling the story of Norma McCorvey and following her from day one of her having to grapple with her situation to her meeting Sarah Weddington to mounting the case that was going to challenge an 1865 statute in Texas prohibiting abortion it's clear that the story comes down weighted towards Norma and Sarah. So from the Supreme Court gave it a point of view, and the storytelling gave it a point of view. I would like to think, however, that in our distilling the transcripts from the Supreme Court and the District Court in Dallas, evenly and accurately on both the J. Floyd side and Sarah Weddington side, that we articulated the legal points made by both sides very clearly.
In other words, you can have a point of view and still be fair in how you treat both sides.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And there was a need on part of the network to do that, and a need on my part to do it too, and Michael's and Allison's. Theirs was different than mine. Mine was, or ours, I should say, was more creative. I would maintain that you don't have good drama unless you have conflict. And inherent to this story, there wasn't much conflict. There was not big battles on Sarah's in Sarah's circle about what she was doing. There were not big battles in J. Floyd's section about what he was doing. The two of them didn't meet in an elevator in a restaurant in a hallway and get into an argument. The way then to set up some kind of dramatic tension, and also I think make very clear what the case was for both of them, both personally and legally, was to carefully articulate their feelings. So to lay out clearly J. Floyd's feelings and scenes like the barbecue scene where he talks about saline solution and the fetus sucking its thumb at a certain time and his need to win this case simply clarified and made more dramatic, I think, Sarah's position. And conversely, the more Sarah talked about what she did and what she was feeling, the more clearly it set up what Floyd was doing. And in the end, you have the best of both worlds. It does none of us any good just to have a polemic or a one-sided discussion. It gets boring.
Rolling Stone reported that when the movie was in production, it was given the name Common Knowledge instead of Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
Because that way the subject wouldn't be that obvious and you wouldn't risk as many protests. One, is that true? And two, were there any protests anyways during the production?
Yes, it is true, and there were no protests. We succeeded in avoiding any problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Holly Hunter plays the role of the plaintiff in the Roe versus Wade case. She's a member of the National Abortion Rights Action League. Was it important to you to cast someone who had a pro-choice point of view in the role?
No. Michael and I just wanted to cast the best actor we could find.
Mm-hmm.
Holly's point of view in politics aside, she was absolutely right for this role, and we went for her. And I'm quite surprised, frankly, that she did it. She took it. I mean, Holly doesn't exactly need this in terms of advancing her career, but she was interested in the script. And the character was someone who just galvanized her in terms of someone that she could play. And she said yes.
The film doesn't use the real name of the plaintiff, Norma McCarvey. Did she not give her permission?
No, a debate went on back and forth between she and Michael Mannheim for actually a couple of years with regard to that. Michael gave her the option. She said, "You can or you cannot." You at that time, she really wanted to remain anonymous. She was a little afraid of the spotlight. And literally up until the day we started shooting, it was in Norma's hands whether or not she wanted to be called Norma in this movie or Ellen, as we call her. But once we started shooting and the first characters called Ellen, the die was cast. Since that time, she's become very active, as you know, doing lots of talk shows and interviews, and was at a march in Washington a while back. And probably, if we were to do it over again at this point, she would be Norma in the movie and not Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Gregory Hoblit is my guest, and he's won several Emmys for his work on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman, and he produced and directed the made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which will air on NBC this Monday evening. What keeps you in television, as opposed to wanting to do feature films?
Oh, I would like to do feature films. Mm-hmm. I would just like to find a piece of material that would light me up. I've had the very good fortune over the years of working on L.A. Law and Hill Street to have been in touch with material, and the writers who write it and the actors who act it, that is better, I would say, maybe somewhat arrogantly, but I'll say it anyway, better than 90% of the movies being made. And Hill Street in particular, and L.A. Law 2, those handful of episodes that we would do each year that were really, really fine, I felt were as good as any feature, well, as good as most features that are being made.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up. I felt that at our best we were good, as good or better than the vast number of features being made, or all but a few.
Were you in on Hill Street at the very beginning?
Yeah, I produced the pilot.
You did. What was the look you were going after?
Well, I believe it was a PBS documentary. Now, this is 1980 or 79 when I saw this, called The Police Tapes, which was a 16mm, actually, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't. It was handheld black and white video of the Fort Apache precinct in the Bronx. And it was about 4 hours of tapes of the comings and goings of policemen in that urban environment that was fascinating. And, you know, the herky-jerky camera and the rough dialogue, and it was mean and kind of inelegant. And when Michael Kozel and Stephen Bochco handed me the script, I said, well, there's a certain way we can do this that I think it'll make it uncommon for television and not make it like Adam 12 or something.
Mm.
And they both lit up to that. We also found a director and a man named Robert Butler, who was kind of a renegade in his own right and really was out to break some rules. And we just set about designing that set and the uniforms and creating the environment to try to make it look and taste and feel and smell like a real inner city urban precinct under siege from its environment, from its community. Michael and Stephen just wrote words that just inspired the kind of lunacy that we began to employ in terms of the camera, in terms of the characters that we cast, in terms of the sound that you heard over the air. It was a lot of fun. Boy, we had a good time.
You were telling us about some of the rules that you went about breaking when you started doing Hill Street Blues. Let's talk about some of the rules that you broke. Handheld camera. You had seen that in the tapes that you were talking about on PBS of the Fort Apache precinct.
Yes.
You worked with a handheld camera on Hill Street.
Yes.
What about
a lot of the time, but mm-hmm. not all the time.
It would be kind of gimmicky if you used it all the time.
Pardon me?
It would probably be gimmicky if you used it all the time.
Well, it would also make you seasick.
Uh-huh.
Our first inclination was to present to the network that we wanted to make this in 16mm, black and white, handheld all the way. That did not fly very well with Brand the Tartikoff and those folks over there at the time. But we found, you know, we found a midpoint that we could agree upon, and one was a kind of judicious and effective use of handheld. I mean, in the roll call scenes and the fights and certain street activity. We also degraded the film. I remember saying to Billy Kronjäger, who was the director of photography on the pilot, the idea would be to take the film in the morning in its raw stock form and kind of run it out on the parkway outside the sound stage and have a couple trucks roll over it and then roll it back up, stick it in the magazine, and stick it in the camera, and shoot. And just so it would have that dense, ugly look. In truth, what we did is we underdeveloped, and then we pushed the film to give it that grainy kind of quality.
Mm-hmm. The Hill Street also always had a really crowded, chaotic feel to it, especially the scenes in the precinct.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways you achieved that was through the overlapping dialogue, because there were always, like, dozens of conversations happening simultaneously.
Yes. I mean, in real life, people don't finish sentences. They, mm-hmm. they're inarticulate. They stumble, as I'm doing on this show. they overlap each other. They don't wait for the other person to finish. And what we would do is construct the scenes in terms of the writing of them that allowed for that. And so people would overlap and interrupt each other. Also, if you remember, a lot of the scenes, or a disproportionate number of the scenes, were shot in one shot. One long shot, sometimes weaving through the precinct, or sometimes just at a desk, where there were no edits. And so anybody in that scene who was speaking would just kind of tumble in on top of the other. I remember one scene that I did sometime in year three, is probably the most satisfying Hill Street that I ever did, where there was something like 18 speaking parts in a 2.5-page scene, or a 3-minute piece altogether, with no edits in it. It's kind of risky, but it's great fun if you can pull it off. You then lay in on top of that the background group. By that I mean, we go into, after we're all finished shooting and it's edited together and it's in its proper form, then I would get a loop group, they're called, and this would be 8 to 10 people to stand in a room with microphones around, look at the picture, and pretend they're the crowd that's surrounding the principals who are speaking.
Oh, no.
and they would make up their own little scenes. They would make up, you know, this drama or that drama, and this discussion about this or that, and then we just lay that in on top of the principal speaking, and that's how you got that sense of just ongoing density and chaos.
That's really interesting. You know, I had read in an article that another thing you did was bring in a comedy group to ad-lib humor lines that you could use in the script.
Well, that's the same group.
That's the same group? Oh, okay.
The loop group is the group. I mean, they are... It's not uncommon anymore in L.A., mm-hmm. and in movies and in television. There are a lot of improvisational groups out of Second City. In this case, it was as an outfit called the Super Loopers. Off the Wall at the time, they're now called the Super Loopers. I used the same group, by the way, in Roe vs. Wade, to be the background in courtrooms, to be the background in the carnival that you saw early on, mm-hmm. in any number of other places, in restaurants. They're all actors. And they tend to. It's good to have comedy actors in there who often are very fast on their feet, and can ad lib very easily. And you just put the picture up, and you say, "I would like some sense of this attitude over in this group of people that you see over on the right hand side of the screen. They're in an intense, dramatic conversation about a murder, and over on the left, they're in an intense, funny conversation about, you know, somebody found a duck in their car. Now just create a scene, and they'll go and do it."
So we're
right
hearing
the
same voices on all these different shows.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Producer and director Gregory Hoblit is my guest, and he's worked on Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, Hooperman, and he produced and directed the new made-for-TV movie Roe vs. Wade, which airs Monday night. Hill Street Blues, I think, has really had a pretty big effect on subsequent television shows. And, you know, we talked a little bit about some of the production things that you did on Hill Street. Let's talk a little bit about working with broadcast standards and practices. Do you feel that you push the limits of what you could show on television in terms of violence or sex?
They would think so. We just were trying to do in language.
In language, yeah.
We were just trying to do our work. Stephen and Michael and the rest of the writers would sit and construct stories. And the stories would then take on a life of their own and a language of their own. And they would have all those elements in them. They write it. We send it over the network. The network, you know, either said, "This is fine, not a problem," or they would go crazy and say, "You can't say this on television. You can't show that. You can't talk about this or that." And then we'd get embroiled in why not? Well, it's bad taste, or it's offensive, or it's too controversial, or it's that language is not appropriate. And then you'd say, "Well, why not?" And this would go back and forth. And Stephen really was the standard bearer on this in terms of the show. He knew what he wanted, and we knew what he wanted to hear and say. No question he was offended when people over there who had a different vested interest were trying to interfere in his creative rights, or what he perceived to be his creative rights. And the give and take would go on, but slowly and but surely we would push back the line which they were trying to draw. And it wasn't bullying back, I would like to think, although they might think that. It was, we'll show you how we can do this and how we can do this in good taste. And in, you know, exhibiting some good manners in the course of it all. And
what's an example?
Well, one that comes to mind immediately. I shot it was a scene in Joyce Davenport's apartment in her jacuzzi bathtub, which was going to have Daniel Travanti and Veronica Hamill ostensibly naked in this bathtub as the bubbles were swirling around, and they said, absolutely not. We cannot have two people whose shoulders are bare and backs are bare in on screen at the same time, of a different sex. And it was like, why not? Well, we just can't, and we won't, you can't do it. And then we said, well, we're going to do it. And they said, no, you're not going to do it. And we said, well, we are going to do it. And then it was like, well, can you do it two ways? One, so they're really way underwater, or the bubbles are very high, or and one the way that you want to do it, and we'll see. Well, the secret's out now. We would really only do it one way, because I didn't want them coming back and saying, well, we didn't like that, let us see the other one. And I'd do it one way and show it to them, and almost 100% of the time they would say, that's okay. And in this case, they said, that's okay, and that stopped being a boogeyman. That stopped being a problem. So from that point on, there were any number of scenes with Daniel and Veronica in the bathtub or in a shower, a bit more intimate and more real in bed scenes. That same situation has carried over to L.A. Law, where there are scenes amongst our principals that I think 5, 6, 7 years ago we never would have been able to do. Now they don't even raise an eyebrow.
I guess if they didn't like what you had given them and only shot one way, you would have been out of a job.
Well, no, I wouldn't have been out of a job. We would have probably had to end up shooting it again.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They weren't going to fire us. They weren't going. I mean, any number of times, I've got to tell you, Stephen in particular, and me in spirit would say to them, "Well, we're going to take our football and go home now. Call us when you want to talk seriously about this."
Uh-huh.
We can do something else. If you don't want Hill Street to go on, we'll stop. I remember back in 1980 when we started making the pilot, there was a particular actor that the head of casting at NBC did not want us to use. He'd had some problem with this guy in the past, or didn't like him as an actor, or there'd been some bad history, and he said no. You can't use them. And I remember Michael and Steven and I were walking up a stairway to our offices at MTM, and Steven turned to both of us and said, well, are we prepared to walk? And we both said, yeah, we can do something else. This is not going to, and we can figure out how to pay our mortgages some other way. Put in the call to the network saying, we either have this actor in our pilot, or we don't do the pilot. And back came a very quick answer, you got your actor. And that is how that's how we proceeded.
Why did you finally leave?
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
5 years was a long time. I made in that course of time, in that period of time, about 120 episodes. I was tired. Stephen left. They asked me to stay and take over his position, and I didn't really want to do that. I just wanted fresh air, like the name of this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I went out and did a few things, not much, in a period of time between the end of L.A. Law, the end of Hill Street and the beginning of L.A. Law. Doing series is very difficult. It really just grinds you into a pulp. It's 7 days a week. It's 12 to 16 hours a day.
It's like making a little movie every week.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to, and that's what we sought to do, Terry. It was really to try to make a feature, one-hour feature film every week. And we could have made it for less money. We could have made it absolutely on time and for budget, I suppose. We could have had our weekends to ourselves. gone home early, but we never would have had Hill Street Blues as it was, unless we did what we did.
What do you think the greatest effects of Hill Street have been on the industry?
Geez, that would be somewhat presumptuous to assess. I would just like to think in keeping what we've talked about with regards to broadcast standards and material, that those doors were opened appreciably by Hill Street. Also, and it also inspired, I think, I would like to think inspired other people as talented as Stephen and Michael and other writers we've had on that show to step up and try to do things. And out of that came some very good St. Elsewhere and Miami Vice when it began. While in terms of content, I would never applaud it. I think they really took some great chances cinematically and in style. 30-something most recently, Cagney and Lacey. I suppose, and I have to be careful how I say this, but I'll say it anyway, that they owe something to Hill Street for having opened the door for programmers at all three networks to know that that kind of work could exist in terms of content, in terms of acting, in terms of style. I'm really pretty proud of that show, I must say.
I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your interest.